been a while, Sean.
It's been, what is that? What song? Who sings that song? It's been a while.
I don't.
Stained.
Okay, yeah.
From my childhood days. Anyhow, yes, it has been a while.
It's been like 3 weeks, I think.
We've been talking in passing, I suppose.
A little bit here and there.
Yeah.
I think we both just had a lot going on.
We had a lot going on. I mean, I was doing jujitsu for like six days a week, six sessions a week. And I was doing, so I would stay for the, I would do the class and then I would stay after because people stay after and they do some more like advanced training and stuff. So I would do that as well. So it'd be like 2 hours. It would end up being like two hours. Man. So last weekend, I thought I was going to die. My body, it was so bad. I was just sore. And so
yeah, that's a lot.
Kind of scaled it back, but it was coinciding with some difficult work that I was doing. I was doing some more money stuff, reoccurring memberships and just things that deals with people's money stresses me out because I know how people get. Like you can pretty much screw everything up, but when you touch someone's wallet, that's it, you know.
Oh yeah, that's like the one thing that people.
Unforgivable
offense if you mess up something with somebody's money.
Yeah.
Although I say that, and Comcast has messed up my bill like four times or whatever at this point, and I still use them.
Yeah.
Turns out monopolies are not a good thing, huh?
Turns out monopolies when running.
Turns out
what should be a utility make things difficult. I think it should be. It's like people use it like a utility now. So, but yeah, that it was just stressing me out. So I was like, I'm going to go train because I'm stressed out. And so I would. And then pretty soon it was a lot. And so this weekend, we kind of taking it a little bit lighter. And I didn't go today specifically because I went yesterday and I was feeling a little tore up. So,
yeah, I mean, you can't go full speed all the time forever, right? You gotta slow down at some point a little bit.
It requires too much food. I don't want to eat that much. But if I don't eat,
sure,
especially water is the most important thing, I think. But if I don't eat that much, I just don't want to eat that much food. So, but it helped. It helped me a lot get through that stuff. And as I've been talking, like, I don't think anyone believes me when I say I have 2 months to redo my app in a different language. It's happened to people. I've started it. I'm budgeting like maybe a full day a week split across different days. So that's like maybe an hour and a half. A couple hours a day, maybe if I need to be, like doing bug fixes or things like that. But the rest of my time is spent fully writing Elixir.
Right. So you were finishing up some major features with shipping and purchasing and that sort of thing and these subscriptions mm-hmm. in the Rails app, and now you're pretty much full time in converting everything over to Elixir, right?
Yeah, and I had started that a while back, so it's not like I'm just straight starting from nothing. I've gotten pretty far into it actually. But the big difference...
But now you're on it like pretty much full time.
Yeah, yeah. And the big difference is there was a major kind of upgrade, like a paradigm upgrade, I suppose, in like Phoenix. So I'm using like my view in my API layer. I'm running through Phoenix. And I know I've talked about a little bit about Elixir in the past, but with the new upgrade to like between Phoenix 1.2 and 1.3, with 1.2, a lot of people were pretty much like their application was Phoenix, right? You're writing a Phoenix application. And the core team of Phoenix, they would much rather you be writing an Elixir application and Phoenix just handle the web layer, you know, sending
right.
views and sending JSON. Because that's really what it's for, everything else. I mean, Phoenix isn't a big framework at all. It's very small. It's just that the way the directory structure was set up, it encouraged people to write everything inside of the Phoenix side, and that's not what you're supposed to do. So, Elixir applications pretty much all have the same structure, and there's the tool that we use is called Mix, and so that's like the package manager, and you can do like Mix a new project, and it generates all of your config file, like your boilerplate config files. It generates your lib directory, it generates your test directory, and stuff like that. And so what's happening is now I'm moving a lot of the stuff I wrote for DK out of that magic web folder. They moved the web folder out of the root because the web folder lived in the root of the directory kind of next to lib. And so that's why people were putting everything in it. They were putting their schemas, they were putting everything when really all your templates and your controllers should just go in there, right? Your actual business logic shouldn't be
mixed. Your business logic doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Phoenix, right?
Nothing at all. Exactly. And so that's the big change is that they moved the web folder out of the root and they put it inside the lib folder. So now it's just a part of your application.
That's kind of funny how such like a, that's really hardly even a change at all.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And yet it's just a different way of thinking about things and kind of looking at things. I like that kind of change.
Well, what's even cooler is that 1.3 is pretty much fully backwards compatible with 1.2. So you could bump it and not do anything. So you could leave stuff where it was. Now, if you want to move the web folder around, then you have to go through and change some config files and stuff and tell it where to watch certain things because it comes with like an auto reloader. So if you change any of your views or templates or whatever, it'll just reload the app for you, which is kind of nice. But you don't have to do anything really. And that's the crazy thing was there was a ton of pushback from people. I think the biggest thing was that there's an idea of context now. And that kind of goes down a whole rabbit hole of like behavior-driven development. And I've read about that a little bit. But there was a lot of pushback because essentially with context now. So before a lot of people were writing their business logic, they're writing way too much of it in controllers. And obviously in Rails, we're like, hey, don't do that. Skinny controllers, fat models. Your business logic shouldn't go in a controller. But with the way things were set up, people were kind of in, like, they were just doing that by default. And so that was another reason why the Phoenix core team was like, we needed to stop this because this is not how you build a scalable app or a maintainable app. So now we have an idea of contexts in which basically you just draw boundaries around your application. And the cool thing is it's not anything specific to Phoenix. It's just a module with functions in it. The only difference is that if you're working with channels, which would basically like send data through WebSockets, or if you're working through controller views, or if you're working through like anything that sends out JSON, you basically never, so there's like the one rule is that you never use repo, and repo is how you interact with your data. So you do like repo dot get, and then you pass it a module, which would be like a post or something, and then you pass it like an ID, right? So repo is kind of the interface that you use to interact with Ecto. And so basically the rule is don't use that anywhere but a context. Don't do it in a controller. For God's sakes, don't do it in a view. Just do it in, like, the only time you're accessing data is through a context. So essentially what is happening is they're saying, hey, instead of writing all this crap where it doesn't belong, just put all of these functions in a module and then treat that as your API. So your actual business logic API is just regular Elixir modules with functions. And then all of the other pieces, all you do, so like say you have a module, I have a module called Marketplace for Design Collective. That Marketplace is how you interact with products and stores and sales being like a collection of products that are cheaper. And so for example, if I want to list all the stores that are approved, I would do marketplace.list approved stores. And that would return me a list of stores that are approved. And so, I mean, that's a pretty simple example, right? But anytime you're getting data or setting data, it comes through that context module.
And so Marketplace is itself a context?
It'd be known as a context, yeah. So it really is just a boundary because like the Marketplace doesn't really need to be concerned with orders, or it doesn't need to be concerned with the cart. It doesn't need to be concerned with shipments or anything. This is purely like what users are looking through before they would start an order or add something to a cart.
Sure. Only when they're viewing things.
Yeah,
right?
So you could like call it a catalog, whatever. I just call it a marketplace because that's what my boss and my other coworkers call our platform, is the marketplace for stores. So I have data structured together inside of that boundary, which would be the marketplace. So anytime you're dealing with a store, anytime you're dealing with a product, anytime you're dealing with a sale, you act on that through the marketplace boundary.
And then all of your actual database calls are happening from within that marketplace.
Yes.
Or within that context.
Exactly. So the marketplace main file mostly just has functions inside of it, like list approved stores or get product or get store or, you know, just kind of get errors and stuff like that. And so also what I'm doing is I'm making sure that like if you're getting something that belongs to something else, so like if you're working with products let me rephrase that. So like if you're viewing a store page and you need to get products that belong to that store, I don't do like, it's not like going through store, like store get all products. I'm going product get all products by store. And so I'm passing IDs in as the second argument pretty much all the time. And I'm just keeping that like a constant. If you need to get related data, don't go through a relation, go straight to the end piece of data that you want, like a product, and pass in an ID that it belongs to or what you would need from that.
Sure.
And that works really well with the functional paradigm. And that was really hard for me to transition to from the first place, because I'm thinking like store.products, right? Well, that's not a thing. So
yeah, that wouldn't, because you don't have a, you don't really have objects in that sense that you're passing around. Most of your data is passed around in like structs, if
exactly.
I'm understanding things correctly.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, let me pull up Barely quick, because I have an, I was talking with a friend, I guess you can call him friend of the show, Rockwell. He's been helping me out a lot with this stuff. And so he said, like a good tip for dealing with context in this way is try to phrase function and functions like create posts with params X for user Y instead of user Y creates X post. So it's like flipping it around, right? Because we can't act on, there's not an like a user object to add to.
Right.
To
you always just act on the thing that you're actually acting on.
Exactly. And then you pass in the data.
You don't use relations. You just say, you just pass in the relations as part of the definition of the thing that you're building.
You give it everything it needs to do what it needs. You don't.
Right.
And that's another really cool thing is that most of this stuff is pretty pure. So my context module is mostly pure. And what I do is I have my main like marketplace file, and then any like tables that it would access. So product, store, and sale, I have individual schema files. And that's where, if you're thinking in terms of Rails, like you say, you define what fields are there, like relationships and stuff like that. That's where I'm doing that. So I have my main marketplace file, and then I have a product.ex, and that's where the schema definitions are. And so it basically just tells Ecto what table to look in and what field should be, you know, what field to access. And so any stuff that's not pure, like writing, I just have a function in there. And so my context really just calls out to that. So the contexts are actually really simple. There's like nothing crazy in there. Any of like the actual data stuff is just in the schema file.
So in those schemas, that's kind of interesting. I assume that you can have like only access certain columns on the table, like if you only care about certain ones.
Exactly.
Or you can probably have like virtual attributes that combine things.
Yes. Yep.
That's pretty cool. That's
yeah,
neat.
So basically you set that stuff up, and that's just an Ecto setting. So you import Ecto. Ecto is not really, it's kind of like an ORM, but it's not an ORM. Like people will yell at me if I call it an ORM. It's not. but it's basically how you map structs. Ecto is a way to map structs to database columns and tables.
Sure.
So that's essentially what you do. In my schema file, I have my setting that tells it this column or this field maps to this column, and this field is virtual field, like a password maybe. So you obviously don't want to store passwords in plain text. So you store it in like an encrypted password, for example. Like if you're using Rails HashSecure password, I think it uses encrypted password.
So I would imagine on that password attribute, you can have like a getter and a setter, mm-hmm. or probably just a setter in this case.
It works pretty much the same way. So yeah. I have my Ecto schema there, and then underneath that, I have any like, I guess you could say like if you're thinking about Rails, you could put your scopes there as well. So that's what I'm doing. So Ecto, you can build your queries in a way that they're chainable, or they're basically buildable, just like Active Record. And so I just have a collection of functions in there, and each one is scoped to doing one thing. And then in my context, I might say like product.approve, product.available, which is checking the number of items, like the stock is checking the stock. And so I would just do product.approved, product.available, et cetera, et cetera, and then repo.all. And that would return me a list of things that meet the criteria.
Nice. That sounds like a pretty cool setup.
Yeah. And what's really cool, and this is my favorite part about it, is it makes things crazy easy to test, because you don't have business logic scattered across controllers. So you don't have all this complex test setup, and then you're sending a request to a controller and like validating responses. You're basically unit testing your context, because that's the only way you're changing and getting data.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm really trying to do the same, to the extent possible, at least in Rails, where it's just, I don't want any business logic at all, if possible, in my controllers.
Right.
Because it's such a slippery slope. You add one little thing, and then it's like, well, now I have to write a bunch of tests to validate mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
And then it's just kind of a a snowball effect where if you do that one time, you're going to end up doing it again and again, and you're eventually just going to have spaghetti controllers.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually, you know what? The other day I was thinking about, okay, so I'm really liking how this works. You're building an API that your API, you're making an API for your actual API to consume. So your business logic, basically, you're just making a public interface that your actual API, your controllers and whatever, uses to pass through the data almost. And so I started thinking, like, you could totally do, like, you could use this approach in Rails too. Instead of, it's just using classes, right? So you just have more classes and you're just abstracting more things away. And so I started to do that a little bit too, as I'm making changes to the Rails app. I'm kind of using the same approach as well. Some people like would read about like form objects and things like that. It's kind of a similar idea, but it's taking that and extending it to how you're working with your data as well. So it almost like be removing some of the fatness from your models, I suppose.
Just into like plain old Ruby classes, you
mean? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's definitely been part of my strategy for getting logic out of my controllers and even skinning up my models a little bit, is to make custom classes for things that are just a plain old Ruby class. Yeah. It doesn't even need to inherit from anything. It's just a Ruby class, because that's really all you need a lot of the time.
Exactly. And I'm not, I'm trying not to go down like the behavior-driven development rabbit hole, because I know there's a lot of dogmatic stuff there. But the actual idea of drawing boundaries around your stuff would help you carve up a model too, because in building out your classes, you're just poros. You can think, okay, what's the boundary for this? And you have a poro for that. You have a class for that. And so that's where
I'm actually writing out a class right now, where all it does is you give it a what's called a nest in NestNotes. It's like our family unit, basically. And you pass that in and to initialize this thing, and it's just called the nest subscription updater. And then I can say update subscription and tell it what I want the new subscription to be, and it just handles all that and does all those things. And it doesn't really have to be on the nest itself, because it's really a separate thing. It's really dealing only with the subscription, not with any of the other nest logic. So it's nice that that's a pretty good chunk of code that I get to pull out of that model. And also then in my controller, I can just deal with this one class and it does all the stuff for me.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you know what's awesome about that even is there's like a lot of people, like when you switch to whatever else language, it's easy to hate on whatever language you came from. Like, for example, a lot of people that have switched to Elixir, there's just kind of like, not all the time, but there's a lot of like firing shots back at where they came from. But what I think is great is that it, like, learning these new ideas, I'm getting different exposure, and I would never have thought this way before. And I'm pulling that back into Rails and making my current application better, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that's such a programmer thing, is the first language you learn is going to take, and we've covered this before, but the first language you learn, it's going to take a long time. It's going to be really hard, and it's going to be very, very confusing for most people.
Yeah.
But then the second language you learn is probably not going to be all that hard. You're probably going to pick it up pretty quickly. Third language, it'll be a breeze. Fourth language, easier and easier. And it's because there are so many interrelated themes and ways of approaching things and thinking about things that just no matter what language you're in, you can move those concepts back and forth between the vast majority of them, at least.
Yeah.
At least modern like web development languages. Even going back to something like PHP, you can really pull a lot of these concepts back and forth. It's not many of these concepts that you're talking about in Elixir aren't something that is inherent to Elixir. It's just that the people building things in Elixir are thinking about things in that way.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can take that. You can take those philosophies to almost any other language.
Yeah, totally. And the cool another really cool thing about Elixir, I think, is that it's built on top of Erlang, which has been around forever. And if there's a if we run into a problem, the Erlang developers or community have already run into that multiple times and already have figured out different problems or like different solutions for it. So I think that's part of where a lot of this comes from, is there's just history there, you know. And not that that's not there with Ruby either, but it's just like I'm getting exposed to things that I had never been exposed to before and ideas that I'd never heard of before. And I'm trying my best to just embrace it and spread it across, even JavaScript. Like, I am learning things that I could use in writing JavaScript. Yeah. And what's funny is that, I was talking to Josiah yesterday, And he's writing a lot of Elixir too right now, actually, for his job. And we were just talking about like focusing, like how I'm able to focus on Elixir right now. And the reason is because I've been using Vue for so long, and Vue handles so many problems for me that it's not like something I need to think about anymore. It's just, if I need to do something, I can do it, you know, which is really liberating for me, because now I can really focus most of my attention on the server side stuff and the back end stuff that I really want to level up on.
Right. Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway for me from all this stuff is just that, once again, spending all your time worrying about a single language or getting too into a single community is probably not the best way for you to become a better developer. Like, broadening what you know and playing with different languages, different technologies, and different ways of thinking is, at least in my experience, one of the greatest ways to level up quickly. And really, really change your perspective and improve.
Yeah, and for me lately, it's been just conceptual things, really. I mean, yeah, I like the language of Elixir a lot. I like some of the features that it has. You know what's funny, the other day is I saw, I don't remember what it's called, to find it for show notes, but there's a way that people can like proposition for things in the ECMA spec. And someone was writing up a spec for pattern matching in JavaScript, which would be freaking awesome, I think.
I also saw there's a proposal out for pipes in JavaScript.
Yeah.
Same syntax as Elixir, even.
Yeah, cool. That's actually what I was looking at, was pipes. I like pipes a lot. It makes my context look great, because I'm just basically acting on the schema module and just piping through what would be scopes.
And I think that could be pretty cool in JavaScript, if only because it gives people another tool. This is something I've gone back and forth on a little bit internally, I guess, is like the splat operator in JavaScript. And I still have kind of mixed feelings on it, but at the same time, people are doing really neat stuff with it. There are some cool little tricks you can do in Vue and in React, where people are actually using the splat operator for good, I would say. And that's something that I was pretty opposed to, actually, initially a couple of years ago.
Right.
And I'm coming around a little bit on it now. And so I'm really trying to be more open to things like that, and just see how people play with new features. And maybe they don't end up being super useful, but maybe they do. It's not like you have to use them just because they're there.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think we have even talked about the splat, like you and I, before we started the show, we've talked about that before.
Yeah, I believe so. It's a long time ago now.
That's a very long time ago. Yeah.
Oh, JavaScript.
But what's cool is that, like, I'm in a place where, yeah, I'm doing, like, some of the stuff I'm doing is stressful, but I'm actually enjoying it, which is awesome. And I even have newfound inspiration for when I'm working with Ruby and Rails and stuff like that. So very appreciative of that. And, you know, Elixir has helped me out a lot with that. I'm just very appreciative of it.
It's good stuff. Good stuff. It's always nice to be pushed to grow.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's really cool. The Elixir community, Slack is great. There's I think it's called Ruby on Rails Link. I was in that for a while too, and the people there are really awesome as well. But I've been trying to stretch myself and share snippets of code more publicly. And so I'll like write some Elixir and pop it in Slack and just see what happens. Most people are nice, you know, but I figure, like, okay, well, I'm never, like, I don't see these people, and I don't really care what this person has to think about me as a person, you know? So if they're helping me write Ruby or Elixir better, I can deal with people being harsh, I suppose, because I could care, like, I don't, like, this person has no bearing on my life, you know? So, and that's hard. Like, I know, I realize it's hard for some people. It comes easier for me because sometimes I just don't care enough to care about that. I could care less what people think.
You've also been performing like music for a long time. So I think that probably helps in some ways too. That performance anxiety.
I'm more
it's tough to put your code out into the world.
I'm more likely to be like, well, screw you too, than like, hey, that hurt my feelings. It's been helping me grow. Shout out to Rockwell. I don't know if you'll hear this. He's been listening to it sometimes. I mentioned it.
But
shout out to him, because he's been helping me like a lot. He's like, you know, you could just like not do what you're doing and then just do this. And he'll like, he'll show me some code. I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for doing that.
I do think that putting your code out into the world, though, while it can be really, really difficult, I still have trouble with that. It's Because whenever you write something, you get to a point where you're like, well, I guess this could be improved and this should be fixed and I could have done this a little better and I should refactor that bit. And it's so easy to, because you're so close to what you've written, to just be like, okay, this is, I can't share this with anyone. There's no way that anyone will ever find this useful or interesting. But the fact of the matter is, when you do share it, even if it doesn't help anybody else, it always helps you.
Yeah.
What I found specifically there is that when I actually decide to release something, I really do put in that extra little bit of effort, that the second 90%, as they say.
Right, yep.
To get it really ready and get it actually polished. And I find when I do that, I learn a lot. Because that's not a process that you always... A lot of times with side projects or just things that aren't your actual job, at least for me, I'll go through and I'll make it and I'll learn some stuff, but that polish, that last step to actually really tighten things up is such an important part to really growing.
Yeah. And you know what? Jackie Gore, I think his name is Jackie Gore. Maybe I'm not pronouncing that right, but he's one of the developers for Statamic, the flat file CMS. And he was tweeting the other day about basically the same thing, like sharing code. And he made a really good point. He was like, I used to just think, you know, sharing code was for the benefit of other people, but really it's for the benefit of myself. I'm sharing code and I'm getting different perspectives. It's just like if you're a musician studying different styles of music, styles you're not used to, because you will learn something from, you know, those styles. Or like, I guess more aptly, something that would fit this metaphor a little better is if you play with musicians that play different styles than you're used to, it'll stretch you and it's going to be difficult, but you'll learn a ton. Same thing with jiu-jitsu. It's really good to train with more than one person. It's training lots of people because everyone has a different perspective and everyone has different tendencies and moves. And it's no different. Like, so I used to think like, okay, well, before I wanted to share this code, I wanted to make sure that it was helpful for somebody else, which is hard because I, you know, it's not like I'm talking to somebody and they're like, can you make this for me? You know, I don't know what's useful to other people. I think in looking around, a lot of the best open source projects out there were useful to one person first. They were useful to the person that was working on them first, and they put it out there. And that's how it gained traction, is that it happened to be useful for other people as well.
Right. Well, I mean, that's an entire business strategy, is make the product that you want, right?
Yeah.
And if you want it, then presumably somebody else will.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So he made a really good point. He was like, now I do it for myself. Now I do it so I can learn. Now I do it so I can get some new perspectives and stuff like that. I'll try to find the tweet. I think it was like a thread of tweets that he was writing about. But he puts out some pretty cool thoughts. So yeah, I'll put his Twitter handle in the show notes. So if people are interested, they can follow. But that's what I'm thinking about too, is, you know, I would like to get involved in the Elixir open source community somehow. And I keep racking my brains like, what can I make? When really what I need to do is just keep working and something will pop into my head and I'll build it for myself first.
Chances are you'll be working on something for Design Collective or just for a personal project or whatever. Right. And you'll be like, oh, I guess this is something that could be packaged up separately.
Exactly.
And hopefully if you've written things well, it'll be very easy to abstract.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that will probably happen because the way that mixed projects are set up, you can... What's really crazy is that you could have like your whole application be, okay, so if you have like an umbrella apps and you have several applications inside of like one package, you could actually build applications that are just dependencies of the main thing. And so you could release them and then pull them. It's a whole thing. It's crazy. But hopefully that'll end up happening. But yeah, that's what I'm doing these days, is I'm writing lots of Elixir